when they go there and they finally try to get help, they're having difficulty doing that. So my comments will be very brief. I just wanted to share a little bit about my own recruitment as a 15-year-old kid in San Bernardino, California, where I was recruited from. And then I want to just turn it over to Ryan, because he actually, in my case, I refused to serve in Iraq, and I applied for conscientious objector status. I was honorably discharged in May of last year. So I went to Cajon High School in San Bernardino, and my first run-in with a recruiter was when I was 15. Career day at my high school consisted of Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard. I personally never spoke to a college recruiter while I was there, and I filled out a little postcard at the table where the recruiter was, and in addition to inviting a former, an alumnus of my high school back after he had finished his airborne training. He was in full kind of paratrooper uniform, and all of the kids were coming up to him and talking about his cool uniform, and I recognized him from the year prior. He was just a year ahead of me. So I went up to the table, talked to them. They also had a tank that was on the basketball courts. There were kids rappelling off the side of the gym, and they didn't have rock walls back then, I guess, or at least they didn't bring one to my high school. So I filled out this postcard, totally forgot about it. I was 15, but certainly the recruiter did not, and they kept me on file, and they knew exactly when I was scheduled to graduate. And so they called me the summer between the junior and senior year and asked, you know, what are you going to do with your life? And at that point, I had no intention of going to college, didn't think I could afford it. I was really naive about, I didn't know anything about financial aid or any of that stuff. And I was also a terrible student. I spent more time at Huntington Beach playing volleyball than I did where I was supposed to be, which was in school. So I signed up when I was 16 on the delayed entry program. So I spent a year in that from the end of my junior year till the end of my senior year. My recruiter wanted to make sure that I graduated, so he actually drove me every day to summer school to ensure that I finished those classes. And he also took me shooting, so I fired my first weapon as a 16-year-old kid in the hills of San Bernardino. So he was kind of like a sort of like a big brother figure in my life, and I grew up in a single parent home. My mom raised five kids, so certainly I didn't have any other people in my life telling me not to do this thing. And even though my father was a Vietnam vet, for some reason I didn't feel it was important to speak to him about my decision to join the military, and he was very disappointed about that, especially when I told him what job I chose, which was cavalry scout, which is just about as dangerous as it gets. My job was to go find the enemy and then call back and call in for reinforcements. So I did that for 4 years active duty, and then wised up a little bit and got into the medical field, and finished the last 10 years of my service as a medic and a nurse and a healthcare instructor. So, you know, I said all that to say that, you know, there are a lot of kids, especially, you know, people from working class backgrounds who don't see college as an option, or perhaps see college as a burden to their parents and want to kind of find their own way to finance their education. And when a recruiter comes to you and says, well, we can get you $40,000, $50,000, I mean, that's more zeros than most kids that age from, you know, working poor or working class backgrounds. And certainly kids of color, like myself, are prime targets for recruitment. Although, you know, obviously the military is majority, you know, working class white folks. That was my experience. But they're targeted neighborhoods. And I live in New York now, and, you know, Brooklyn and Harlem, and these places are where the recruiters spend most of their time. They roll up to high schools in Harlem with huge Humvees decked out with sound systems and video games and all of these things. So this is what we're up against in terms of educating kids about the military. Now, IBAW's approach to what we call truth in recruiting is we never try and talk anybody specifically out of joining the military, but we try to tell them, okay, here's what the recruiter's telling you. This is what you need to know about actually what happens in the military, and that it's not all, you know, it's not all fun and games, certainly. And the promises that they make you might not always pan out. It's always what to the needs of the military, and that the mission always comes first before whatever you've been promised. You know, so they'll see a kid playing basketball and say, "Oh, well, you can join the Army basketball team. Did you know that?" And get a kid to sign up for the infantry for 2 years because he thinks that he can eventually try out for the Army basketball team. Now the odds—I mean, it's about as hard to get on the Army basketball team as it is to get into the Olympics. I mean, it's very difficult. But you know, it's enough to get the kid to sign the contract, and you know, in some cases it does pan out for people, but by and large, you don't necessarily end up in that kind of position. And what I'll sum up by saying that what we've been up to since Winter Soldier in March was we took our stories to Congress, and we had an event called Winter Soldier on the Hill, where out of Iraq Caucus and the Congressional Progressive Caucus took some time out of their very busy schedules to listen to what their troops had to say about their treatment at the VA, different issues that they faced in terms of stop loss, people seeking mental health care while they were in the military, and you know, there's a culture in the military where if you report it, you're somehow being weak or trying to get out of work or whatever the case might be. And so it's very much discouraged for people to actually seek any kind of mental health treatment. There's a lot of stigma around it. And we edited the testimony from Winter Soldier into a book that was just released last month from Haymarket Books, which we have available on our website, ivaw.org. I was hoping to have a shipment of books to arrive here. Sadly, UPS and the hotel did not work out. So, but we do have also, like I mentioned, we played this version, which is just a one-hour edit of a four-day event. So obviously it's not all the stories, but there are plenty of them on our website as well. You just go to ivaw.org/Winter Soldier, and you can watch the full testimony of all of the folks that were there, Iraq veterans, Afghanistan veterans, Iraqi civilians, and folks who kind of gave context to the stories that we were presenting. So we also have, Ryan has a whole sack of these. So if you want to take these stories back to your communities, it's a 65-minute edit of the event. We're asking for a suggested donation of $15, but you know, that's less important than you taking these stories back home and letting people know what we are up to. We're also putting together a full DVD set of the event so that people can kind of watch the whole thing and not have to stream it online. So that'll be available soon, hopefully for the Christmas season, on our website. And a great stocking stuffer to traumatize all of your friends about what's happening in Iraq. So I will leave you with that and turn it over to Ryan, who actually spent time on the ground in Iraq, and he's a local member. I thought it was important to have a local LA chapter member come and just tell you a little bit about what these folks are doing, and you can ask him questions about his service. So thank you.
Hello, I'm Ryan. I'm the vice president for the LA chapter. There was a lot of LA traffic here, so I actually missed a screening to get down here this morning. But I just wanted to really basically go into, I guess I was listening to the recruiting and all that stuff, and think that it's important that the talk about post-traumatic stress as well. So I figured I'd just read something real quick. Sometimes you can't just bandage your wounds and wipe the sweat from your brow, put down your gun and take your boots off. It's not so easy to burn the scars of war forever in the sands of Iraq when they follow you into every crowded room, transporting you back at the sound of every crack, invading your sleep in every dream, making you wish you could return to the world of ignorance where the only bandages you wore had smiley faces on them. The sweat from your brow was a result of hours of tag, and the only gun you owned was loaded with water, and you only wore boots to go sledding. I wrote that a couple days ago. But, you know, and I spent my time with Infantry Battalion in the Marine Corps, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, Alpha Company, and I was deployed just after a year of my training. I had only been in for just about a year by the time I hit the ground in Ramadi in 2005. And it was war, and at first when I got there, I believed in everything because the way the Marine Corps broke me down, and told me that they were building me back up, but they really weren't. They were just breaking me down to do what they wanted me to do. And I never questioned the war, and I never thought to question the war, really. And when I got there, it was so exciting for me to think that I would be fighting for my country. And it was already evident with the veterans who are already veterans, my seniors. You know, if they even heard me talking about, oh, I want to get in a gunfight, they would get mad at me. And I never really understood that. I'm like, well, come on, let's go get in a gunfight. Like, that's what we're here to do. And until we started taking contact and Marines started dying. And, you know, and then I started questioning, like, well, what am I doing here? You know, like, why are my friends dying? And I couldn't come up with a reason, ultimately, when I started thinking about it. And on June 15th, 2005, Alpha Company took a total vehicle KIA. Three of the guys in there were very close to me. We were very good friends. And after that happened, I really decided, like, I need to figure some stuff out, because I was going through a lot of turmoil, trying to figure out what was going on and why I was there, and, you know, why people are dying. And I still couldn't come up with it. But the anger and the rage that I had in me was, like, took precedence over my lack of knowledge of why I was there. And looking back now, at the things that we did after some of our friends got hurt, or after somebody got hurt, that walked the line of a extremely small rule of engagement, that really, you on one day you could be on one side of it, and on the next you could be on the other side. That's how quickly the rules of engagement changed. And seeing the things that we did to the Iraqi people, I really decided then that I was no longer for the war. And I finished my tour of duty. I came home, and we had a company formation with the whole company at the end of the day. You do that at the end of every day to, you know, get accountability. And there was a Marine who had asked to go speak to the chaplain to get mental health. And so they held a company formation with the whole company there, and then told them, okay, now you can go see mental health because you're a wussy and you can't handle, you know, you can't be a man. And so now you can go cry your little eyes out to the wizard. That's what they call it when you go to see somebody for mental health. They call it, you're going to see the wizard. You know, it's like their way of beating it down into you that we're, you know, that you're crazy or you're weak for not agreeing with the things that we did in Iraq. And so I joined IVAW when I got out, and I've been at the LA chapter. We've been really active, and just lately we did what's called Operation First Casualty, where we did a combat patrol down Santa Monica Promenade, and we had volunteers to act as Iraqis. And basically what we did was we did a combat patrol, and the volunteers were great. As sad as it is to say they were great, they were completely willing to let us beat the hell out of them on the street, and we did. And so that you can watch videos of that. That's been done by other chapters as well. It was done at the Democratic National Convention. It's been done all over the country. It's a really cool way to bring, like, hey, this is what's going on. You can't close your eyes to this, and it really makes people notice it. And you know, I can honestly say that Iraq Veterans Against the War has single-handedly saved my life. And I'm sure that I'm not the only one that can say that. I'm sure there's a lot of people that can say that, because when I came to IVAW, I was broke, I was tired, and I was drunk, and I didn't know where I was going. I didn't have a plan. I didn't have anything, really. The VA system had let me down. The Marine Corps had let me down. You know, my friends who are for the war let me down because they have now expelled me. I'm no longer okay to talk to them. They want nothing to do with me, the guys that I served with, because they're still for the war and I'm not. And, you know, and I think part of the reason that veterans are having such problems, especially, like I said, with that rule of engagement, is it's not just watching your friends pass away that sticks with you forever. It's the fact that why is it okay to kill a guy shoveling today just because he's shoveling, and then tomorrow they tell you, oh, well, you can't do that anymore. That's against the rule of engagement. So now I have to deal with the fact that I just killed some guy shoveling because they told me that it was okay, and now it's not. So now they're telling me that it's not okay, and to me, they're basically telling me that I just killed somebody for nothing, that I just murdered somebody. And I think that's a big thing where people don't understand what the rules of engagement. And that's why it's so important to like understand that when you make a rule and then you change it, I can't unkill that person. We can't unkill the men and kids that we killed. We can't do that. And so I think it's really important for people to understand that as well. A lot of times with PTSD, that's a big thing. It's a big thing for me. It's a big thing with other vets that I know. So I don't know how much am I going over here.
Do you want to take questions?
Oh, sure. Yeah, if anyone has any questions, yeah, we can.
How about questions for the panel? You have to wait a minute.
Okay.
Questions? It's a little overwhelming. Can you stand up? Yeah, they have a $20 billion recruitment budget now. So good for you for doing that.
Can you stick around and talk to Ben?
Excuse me?
I'm sorry, could you just stick around and talk to Ryan afterwards? He's here in LA as well. That would be great.
Question here.
Yeah, I don't have a question.
Can you stand up so people can hear you? The Republican National Convention.
Right. Is anybody there? We hosted a large group of IFOP people, and they led that march with the parents of a casualty and a coffin and our Minnesota chapter president, and it was right in front of the march, and it was not covered. Local media. They only covered the violence of people who didn't have anything to do with people. Now, there was some other coverage throughout the world and in other areas of the United States of IPOC, but this group and what they're saying is being ignored by our major media, and it's being controlled, as far as I'm concerned, by a forces that we're not sure what's going on. So that's, you know, that's my comment, and I commend these people for speaking out and getting up there and marching against the war. And I wish more people knew about it.
Thank you. Okay, thank you all for coming, and I'm sure our panelists will be here for another couple minutes.
My name is Alan Andrews, and you spoke at the panel yesterday with my partner, Rocky Sinha.
Yeah.
I was just doing the kind of level. But we did that research, and part of that was kind of an advocacy campaign we tried to do at the time, because writing papers and stuff like that. But another organization that I started, I think she mentioned, was Crisis Health Initiative. And it's a humanitarian organization that I started with other students, med students at the AMPH program. And I'd love to, yeah. That's what we do is bring Iraqi physicians here to be trained at school for the health. And we talked to some psychiatrists about their health affairs, and we were trying to get some funding to bring two more physicians to the work, and I'd like to bring some to the University of Washington.
Good idea.
One of you, yeah.
We'll get in touch.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, we're gonna be a little late. I do actually know. I know exactly where we're going because I happened to walk by it on my way to down the
chapters where you can, you know, help and do some of this work. I mean, I would go in my car and, you know, do what you did. I said, I mean, you know, I would do what you did. I said, yeah, I could do that. You know, I would identify. I would do that. I feel like I could do that. I mean, are there like chapters around the country? Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, okay, there's something we could do. Yeah. That's it.
We also mitigate up the discharges because what they do is they sit for 15 minutes and they give them a personality disorder so they can discharge them. And there's no history of that. Nothing. No predetermining thing that says they had a personality.
And
it's not a legal, even legal or ethical assessment that they're giving them.
Oh, that's great.
There are more physicians you're going to have to support our process, the better. Because we're really working at trying to
get do that.
Disability and mental health success. Like you just got 15%.
Yeah.
And when we go back to the hospital, they know this is what they're every time we
get. Yeah, I'm sure. Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
It seems to me that I know some people.
you do train people. Yeah, that's how I was thinking.
Yeah, you if you
American. Like, just
I'm sure.